Okay, so it's Q&A, and before I get to the ones in the, there's one that came in on I don't know, online. So question was, in the sutta you spoke about this morning with the dialogue between Ananda and Sariputta, could you say more about the reason people don't become enlightened in this lifetime? If I understood you correctly, you said it was that people don't recognize the decline. What does this mean? That wasn't, there was four things that I mentioned. So that, and that's part of the sutta. Oh. Right. Okay, I'll do that again so people online can hear, because the question's actually online as well. So in the question was, in the sutta you spoke about this morning with the dialogue between Ananda and Sariputta, could you say more about the reason people don't become enlightened in this lifetime? If I understood you correctly, you said it was that people don't recognize the decline. What does this mean? There was not just, decline was one thing. What I talked about was four things that the Buddha, Sariputta mentioned, and it's perception. It's all around perception, association, recognition. And so that decline is just one of them, just seeing things that decline, but then also seeing things that lead to stability. The third one was that leads to distinction, and the fourth one was what leads to penetration. So those are four different aspects of perception, and recognizing how these things come about, so that we can actually pay attention to what and avoid that which is going to lead to our decline, difficulty, things of a problematic nature. We can develop more aspects that are stable, solid, stability. Everybody wants some stability in their life. And things that lead, that more refinement of both perception and consciousness, but then also to penetration, to understanding, and realization. Those are, but it is predicated on what we perceive. And how, what we associate with, what comes up in the mind, and what do we consider as we go through? Because otherwise, it's nice to have a wishful thinking, but you've got to align your mind with what you're hoping for, what you're wishing for. Okay. Tibetan Buddhism seems to have a stronger emphasis on compassion and emptiness as a practice. Can you please talk about this from Ajahn Chah lineage, including steps as to how it is done? Tibetan Buddhism is a big umbrella, so in the same way that, say, Theravada Buddhism is portrayed more around the say Vipassana meditation elements when it comes to the West, then similarly the as Tibetan Buddhism comes more to the West, and there's clear choices to what are people interested in, and what people are interested in is compassion and emptiness, the aspects of liberation. And for in terms of Ajahn Chah, the Ajahn Chah lineage, certainly the aspects of, I think one of the aspects that I've, from my own perspective on the approach, Ajahn Chah really emphasizing a complete path, and that when one commits to a complete path of training, both in generosity, in kindness, in virtue and integrity, and in the aspects of mindfulness and creating a clarity of mind, along with a reflective insight into the nature of things, where you end up when you have cultivated that path is with a whole lot of compassion and emptiness. That's like Ajahn Mahabua in the Thai forest tradition is he's considered a very fierce and he was, and he really did not suffer fools. very, very fierce, very, very sort of demanding. And then one time he was asked, what is the mind of an arahant like? And his immediate answer, without sort of a second thought, only compassion. So it's the nature of the liberated mind. Can you expand more on the seeing through of vipassana? Well, vipassana is, as I said, as a, it's a, as a name, what it means, literally means the seeing through, but it is, oftentimes it's considered like a kind of meditation practice, which is not quite, in terms of the tradition, and the vipassana is like the result of the practice, it's not a meditation or a particular technique, but it is the result of clarity and insight, seeing through, or vipassana, as quite rightly translated as insight, but it's again it's that cultivation of a complete path that allows the obscurations to drop away and to see things in their true nature. And seeing things in their true nature is what vipassana is. So seeing clearly. And in general, when it's articulated of what is, well, when you talk about, oh, this is a, say, vipassana insight, well, what is the insight into, and the way of defining or describing is always around the impermanence, unsatisfactory, non-self nature of all things, whether they are mental or physical, external, internal, near or far, coarse or refined. Everything is going to be of a impermanent, changing, inconstant, uncertain nature. It's never going to, it doesn't have the capacity to actually satisfy and make one fully happy, fully content, fully replete. And there's no way that one can hang on to it and call it, this is me, this is mine, this is what I am. It's just not possible. It's the nature of the nature of phenomena. Again, whether one's speaking about the world, speaking about the self, that's its fundamental nature. So it's just sort of seeing through that. And if you, when one sees through that, then one isn't placing one's best bets on a losing horse. And one starts paying attention to what is it that really leads, what does lead to peace, what does lead to freedom, what does lead to a sense of clarity and realization. So that's the purpose of, say, of vipassana, is to just see through so that one can make these very wise choices with one's, where one puts one's attention, where one puts one's effort and energy. Okay. Please speak about sense consciousness and how the release of attachment is achieved. Well, I mean, it's through sense consciousness that we experience things. It's through sense consciousness that we get deluded by things. Again, this ties into vipassana in the sense of insight. It's through the knowledge of the senses and seeing clearly their nature that we experience them. Because just the way that sense consciousness works, it's always going to be... one's going to experience it or in conjunction with a pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, and neutral feeling. And we tend to, if we don't experience it clearly, if we don't see through it, then we tend to, bite the bait of the pleasant or the unpleasant, or get confused or bored by the neutral. And so then the release of attachment is seen through the clear understanding the nature of our experience. Well, this is how it works. This is how it is. Can't be any other way. And one is willing to release, one's willing to let go. Ajahn Chah once said, Dhamma practice is not difficult. There's only two things you need to do, know and let go. which is easy to say, and or easy for him to say. But it does sort of, because oftentimes we tend to get into these convoluted machinations of trying to figure everything out and get everything labeled properly and get it all in a nice neat row. But in the end, all we need to do is know it clearly and not cling, not grasp, not react to the sense contact of what is pleasant, what is unpleasant, what is neutral, and of course that's not easy, but it's when we see more and more clearly that every time we bite that hook, we're caught and it hurts. And tying it into the one of the early questions, that's also the root of compassion, because it's when you see that this is what we have been doing, and this is what the whole world has been doing, and this is what binds people to suffering, binds beings to dukkha, and truly worthy of compassion. And so it's that seeing clearly and being willing to understand. And it's sort of understanding process. It's really paying attention to the process of of how the how does this process work of desire and attachment? How does the process of attachment and clinging, how does that work? How is the process of letting go and relinquishing? How does that work? So it's paying attention to the process. And as we study that, we learn that, we pay attention to that, and penetrate it more and more deeply, then release and relinquishment become the natural response. I had two losses in May of this year, a dear friend and beloved family dog. I continue to feel these losses deeply. How does one know the difference between appropriate grieving and honoring the memory of a beloved versus clinging and attachment? Thank you very much. Well, the result of clinging and attachment is suffering. So that at any point or in any experience that we are feeling discomfort, dis-ease, a sense of kind of like a overwhelming sadness, as opposed to like a poignancy, because because it isn't as if you don't acknowledge or recognize loss. I mean, loss hurts, and when we've had a connection with beings that we feel a sense of connection with, then there is a missing of that. But it's also if it goes in, because oftentimes it's the sense of loss is usually because it's personalized. It's sort of, it's my loss, my friend, my family member, my, and it's not that, it's not, and you, and just to sort of, oh, there's a switch there that you turn that off. That's not how it works. Or that somehow, just because you've been practicing Dhamma, you don't feel anything. But it's starting to, again, recognize, understanding process, really investigating, so that there's a poignancy and a kind of, like a kind of sadness that one experiences, but it's not personalized. It's a motivating force for increased commitment to practicing Dhamma. That sense of point and the there's a word in the Pali which is the sangveka, which is like that sadness that is a tinge with a sense of urgency. So there's a sense of urgency, like this is the nature of all conditioned things, is to is separation and loss, and I got to do something about this. But if it gets really frantic, then that's suffering. But it can really nurture a commitment to practice, commitment to good spiritual friendships, commitment to the path, and that's really, really important. So to be letting it in, and of course it isn't as if one, yeah, all of, again, we learn these things only by going through them, and as we start to recognize and feel loss, then it, because it can be such a motivating force for nurturing the sense of commitment to what's truly good. I think what comes to mind is Ajahn Chah. I had the good fortune of meeting Ajahn Chah when I was fairly young. I had a tremendous commitment to him as a teacher, and he actually led a pretty short life. His teaching career was over when he was about 61, 62. All that he accomplished was done before then. And then subsequent to that, he was bedridden, incapable of speech and unable to help himself for the next 9 or 10 years. But I'd say my grieving for Ajahn Chah took place during that period of his illness, and getting used to the fact that he was, okay, this is going in one direction only. And then when he died, there was a tremendous sadness, but not really grief. It was sort of okay, that phase is over, and what can I do to honor his memory? What can I do to live up to what he taught and trained and set the example for, so that it's used in a way to nurture the wholesome and the skillful, whereas and it's encouraging and uplifting in at the same time. But so often we will, the sort of like ordinary grief is sorrow, sadness, and at one's personal loss, and it's that personalization of experience that gets us into trouble over and over and over again in different ways, whether it's on whether it includes dying and separation or not. It's that personalization, identifying with experience, so that it's that. So clinging and attachment are those elements of identification and not wanting things to be the way they are. It shouldn't be this way. And I think of, again, sort of think of Ajahn Chah. I mean, I'm way past 62. And he had so much to contribute and contributed so much. I say it shouldn't be this way. Well, I can think that, but that's really stupid. Because it doesn't get anybody anywhere. So how do we deal with things as they truly are? Okay, I have a request for a Dhamma talk. The five aggregates, please. We'll see if it comes out as a Dhamma talk or put it as I said, I don't have a plan, so I don't have a syllabus of how I'm going to teach you all. But as we're just as a broad overview, I mean, this is the five aggregates are really, and because we're just talking about identification and clinging, and that's when the Buddha talks of the source of suffering, cause of suffering, it is the the clinging and attachment to these five aggregates of being, form, physical form, whether our own physical bodies or wherever, and the feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling, sanya, perception, memory, association, just these are functions of mind. So clinging and attachment to mind and body, sankharas, the mental formations, and so that this is all of the emotion and thinking that we experience. And then it's the sense consciousness, it's the bare recognition, knowledge of the senses, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and consciousness of the mind itself, so that these are, and they are I'm You say they form the basis of when we think of self, of me, of mine, it is one or other or a conglomerate of these five aggregates of being. And there isn't, and the Buddha gives an image of the sense of self, and said it's like a dog that's tied to a post, and whether it walks or sits or lies down around, it's tied to this post, and whatever it doesn't stray from that post. In the same way that whatever the refinement or coarseness of our experience, and it's our sense of self is based on these five aggregates. It doesn't stray from that area. It's pretty fundamental and basic. But of course, it's incredibly varied and there's a lot there, but in the end, it's just sort of that's all that is: form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. It's not a lot. I'm a mother to four kiddos, one of whom has special needs. I've been in a long season of trying to sit regularly, and I'm lucky if I can get 10 to 15 minutes a day. I'm wondering if there are practices that come to mind that one can do when one's frequently around little ones, some who have high demands, needs. I try to practice mindfulness, but I feel the loss of a longer regular sit. Thank you. I mean, I can appreciate that, but the reality is the needs of the children take precedence, and that one has to allow the practice or the training, because oftentimes when we think of practice, okay, I've got to be sitting, and that's a fairly prescribed spectrum of what we call practice, and so that learning how to say rather than conceiving of practice as this, which I have to get back to in order to have practiced, it's sort of reconfiguring one's conception of practice, and recognizing, I mean, one is precepts, refuges. Again, refuges and precepts. These are really do we consciously return to a refuge? Do we acknowledge and have a appreciation of the kind of restraint and integrity that? Because oftentimes we'll just overlook it. Because I think for the most part, especially in the West, people are really sincere, and the practice of precepts is fairly natural, and so that just taking a bit of refinement to it and making it conscious. Oh, I'm living with these precepts. I'm living with an integrity of conduct, and then to be able to delight in it. I mean, that's actually the like with meditation techniques or practices, the like formal sitting, paying attention to the breath coming in and coming out, mindfulness of breathing. In the, say, the classical commentary on the path, Visuddhimagga, path of purification, it's a commentarial text that was done probably about a 1,000 years after the Buddha it was compiled. But in Theravada world, it's really highly regarded. It is, there's a pulling together, a compiling of all the different meditations that the Buddha recommended, encouraged in the discourses, and there's 40 of them altogether. So that broadens the spectrum of what is possible. And some of them are, there's 10 of them that are recollections or discursive meditations. And the sila anusati is to recollect to. And it's a conscious recollection. And to be able to direct one's attention to the recollection of the precepts, having kept the precepts. A recollection of the integrity that one's been living by. And that's a great source of clarity and peace. Chahatonasati, recollection of generosity. Just because sometimes we do things and we don't make it conscious, so it's as if we didn't do it. And it's really important to make it conscious. Not to sort of puff oneself up in some way, but to solidify the goodness that we have done. It's really, really important, because think of the in the Sri Lankan tradition, and in their culture, one of the things that I have heard, I'm not that familiar with Sri Lanka culture, but one of the things I've heard that they do within the culture is that they will, either somebody will gift them a book or they have a book themselves, and it's like a journal, and then they'll write down things that they have done that were really meritorious, good, wholesome, skillful, things that they found really delightful in terms of, especially in terms of, you know, what is say from the Buddhist terminology, what is punya, the wholesome qualities that lead to happiness and well-being. And they'll make a journal, and they themselves might go back and read it from time to time. These are times of difficulty or feeling bereft in some way, then to go back and to recollect that. And then also it's what they do at the end of someone's life, on their deathbed. Some other relative or friend will read that back to them, so that as they're approaching death, there's this brightness of recollection. And you know, it's just really important to see the power in that punya, that skillfulness, and living a really good life in its true sense. And caring for the needs of little kids, that takes precedence over your desire to sit meditate sometimes. I mean, if you have the opportunity, and it depends on the family situation, then you have time when you can make time, but to also turn direct attention to, you know, other ways that one can be brightening the mind, and certainly like just mindfulness of the body in terms of. Not in a formal sense of, okay, 32 parts of the body going through it as a formal meditation, but that sense of contact, of touch, of a clear comprehension of circumstance, of time and place. There's a clarity that starts to build when one gets more connected with the body. And one can be consciously, as you start to pay attention to your body, you start recognizing the different ways and different areas of the body that either get agitated or get tightened up and you can be consciously relaxing or settling or soothing or settling in just through the experience of the body. And just because sometimes we, you know, just like our facial muscles sort of tighten up so much, our shoulders, pit of the stomach. What does it feel when we're uncertain? Okay, how do we relax? We're hesitant about something, and you can feel that tentativeness in how we're doing something or just accomplishing a task. And so bringing mindfulness and bringing a sense of change to that. So there's a clarity that begins to establish itself in a very, you know, wholesome way, a skillful way. As an example, I mean, there's a few people here who've been to a Bhaiagiri and know Debbie, and she was one of the founders of the Sangapala Foundation and the Bhaiagiri Monastery, and has lived at the monastery since almost its beginning. And anyway, her father, I mean, now he's 95, 96, and Debbie's mom passed, I don't know, 7, 8 years ago, something like that. And then the two of them worked together well as a pair. She had a really sharp mind and was totally there, but her body was falling apart. He's very healthy physically, but short-term memory loss and, you know, just not so there. He's very happy, which is a basic. I mean, he's lived a really good life, but he needs attention. You have to keep an eye on him all the time. And so Debbie and her siblings have been sharing out duties. But when the pandemic came, then it was way more difficult to do. So Debbie ended up being the primary caregiver. And so that kind of responsibility and duty is 24/7, and not a whole lot of time for sitting meditation. And even when it's quiet and he's sleeping, you still can't. You got to be alert. You got to be present. So she is, for a while, she was lamenting the loss of time for sitting, but recently she's been, and I've been encouraging her in different ways, and she's, and of course she's a savvy, solid practitioner anyway. But she was saying just how grateful, how her practice has changed and how it's deepened, even without the ability to have a steady sitting practice. So I think it's when, again, that shifting attention and putting attention, giving importance to what needs to be important. And of course, it's just that mindfulness, clear comprehension, reflective insight into the nature of our experience. As you do it with kindness, you do it with presence, you do it with grace, and good things happen. So that's the end of the bowl.
Ha ha ha.